everyone. Welcome to the Steve Maxwell Drums Podcast. Don't forget to check us out on our website at www.maxwelldrums.com and then our reverb stores at Steve Maxwell Drums-Chicago and Steve Maxwell Drums-New York. We also have social media, two Instagram accounts, at Maxwell Drum Shop Chicagoland and then at Maxwell Drum Shop. And then also on Facebook, Steve Maxwell and Steve Maxwell Drum Shop. And then, of course, check us out on Twitter, at Maxwell Drum Shop. We will interview players, collectors, drum and cymbal builders, and also teachers about all things percussion. And you can go to YouTube if you want to see the video. We'll have pictures of drum shops, drum sets, badges, cymbals, all kinds of fun stuff. So let's get started. We hope you enjoy it. All right, 3, 2, 1. So I'm here with Tim Wilsey, good old friend of the shops, good old friend of mine. And Tim has been a local musician. We'll talk about kind of how he got into music, all that kind of stuff. He does a lot of stuff with big groups, kind of educator as well.
Yep.
And then, has a good long history with the shop. So yeah, say hi, Tim.
Yeah. How's it going?
Good pretty to see good. You. Yeah, likewise. How you doing, man?
Doing good. Beautiful day outside. Great to be here and great to see all the vintage gear here.
For sure. Yeah. Great to have you, man.
Thanks.
So, let's talk about where are you from originally?
So, born originally in Berkshire County, Massachusetts, Pittsfield, Massachusetts, which was west part of the state. About an hour, 45 minutes west of Boston.
Cool. That's close to, Rhode Island, where my family hails from.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. My parents are both from Rhode Island. I grew up here, but me and my brother grew up here, but they're from Rhode Island originally.
Since you say that, now I remember them telling me, yeah, they got some great beaches down in Rhode Island.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. They have big mansions over the Newport.
Uh-huh.
It's beautiful, the East Coast.
Oh, but, it is.
So, did you do the whole college thing?
Yeah, so I went to school at Amherst College in Massachusetts.
And what about even with high school? Like, could you tell me a little bit about... Maybe, just like what first got you into music, if you had like a really inspirational family member or teacher.
Dad. Dad was a drummer. Dad was a jazz drummer originally. Parents were originally from Maywood, so the Chicago area.
Oh, okay.
Dad got a job out in the East Coast and started living lived out in Western Massachusetts. I was the only one from the family born. My sisters are all from the Chicago area. So they picked up and moved. Moved out to the East Coast. I was born out there, and before I could even walk, I was on my dad's lap playing the drums and behind cool. a Slingerland set, and got going on big band music right away.
Nice. Yeah.
So from there, I went to school all in Massachusetts.
Did you have a good high school music experience?
Actually, no. I had So I went to Catholic school all my life. Didn't have music programs. It was all academics and sports related. So what I did was played the local scene and studied privately. I actually used to study with a guy named Randy Kay, who was from Brooklyn, New York. And so I got started with him at the Berkshire Music School and studied with Randy probably around eighth grade, freshman year of high school.
So was your dad a gigging musician?
Yeah, he did. He was gigging in Chicago. By the time he moved out to Massachusetts, he stopped working as a musician, but eventually he found his way back in the music industry. He was VP of sales and marketing for a company which became the largest cassette manufacturer for a long time.
Oh, cool, man. I want to do a podcast about cassette tapes at some point. I talked about that in one of the earlier ones. That's cool. So they do you remember the name?
Yeah, Polymatrix was the name of the company.
I don't know if I've ever seen one of those before. So many different types of cassettes, grades, and everything. Yeah.
He was instrumental. He actually created some things for the company. He'd made the I don't know if you remember the world of cassettes going back. There used to be the double cassettes cases where you would open a band or an artist would put out a double album on cassette.
I think I've seen a couple of those. It's been a long time, but I think I have seen. I think I remember maybe. At some, remember when there were stores that sold, music?
Yeah. Long time ago.
Record stores, yeah.
Record stores.
You have your double CDs, and I think I do remember a couple double cassettes.
Yeah.
Was that his idea? Oh,
yeah.
Cool.
He created that, and then I remember one day we're sitting there at the dining room table, and he comes in and he throws down this round silver disc, and I said, "What the heck is that?" And he said, "That's what music's going to be."
That's the future.
Years. That's the future, exactly. Yeah. And that he left the company and started his own company and got into compact discs.
Cool.
And manufacturing basically the boxes for compact discs.
Oh, nice.
And so he worked a lot he did business in New York, and then he did business out in the West Coast in Los Angeles. He dealt with all the record companies, Warner Brothers and Capitol Records. And
yeah, it seems like a good solid business to be in.
It was. It was at the time, yeah.
Yeah. I just
make sure I always do this.
Sure.
10 minutes in, make sure all the cameras are working. Yep, look good. Last one I did, this one stopped working.
Okay.
All right, we're all good. Yeah, fortunately I had a third angle, but I've given up on the third angle for now because my cell phone, well, it's actually full right now. And it's an iPhone, and getting the big files from iPhones onto PCs is like...
takes a long time.
It's impossible. It'll start the upload, and then it'll just stop like 75% of the way through, 2 hours in.
Oh,
it's
wow.
Like, it's so annoying. But that's my cross to bear.
Yeah.
You don't have to worry about that.
That's a headache and a half, though.
For sure.
That's a headache and a half.
Yeah. But anyway, so you're let's talk about your kind of earlier experience with music. I imagine your dad was probably like your first teacher.
Dad was my first teacher.
Same with me.
Exactly.
My first teacher.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, growing up in the house, the big thing was to stay up late and watch Johnny because Buddy was going to be on, Buddy Rich, of course, or Louie Bellson, or I wanted to see Ed Shaughnessy. So I learned really early. We lived in a ranch house, and I had my door in my bedroom. If you cracked it just right enough, you got a perfect view of the TV. So I would be sent to bed, but I would stay up and just crack the door, and I'd be able to see, okay, Buddy's on tonight, so I could watch
That's
it.
Cool.
And then my dad, of course, would yell and say, Karnak, go to bed. You know what I mean? You know, stop staying up. So listening to records, my dad, you know, watching him, listening to him, being around him, studying with Randy Kay privately by the time I got into eighth grade, freshman year. And then working with older musicians. That was the best experience, to be able to go out and play with older musicians, guys that are more experienced and knowledgeable.
So what do you remember the first group that you played with, your first band?
No, I don't. I remember the great thing that I think helped me with my career was I played in three or four bands at the same time. So I played in a rock band, and we were doing a lot of the hair band stuff, the things from the 80s, a lot of the rock stuff, straight ahead stuff. And then I discovered I loved R&B, and I loved soul music, and I loved Prince. Nice. So then I was in a band doing that type of music, and I loved that music.
Did your dad do rock at all, or was he kind of like strictly a jazz guy?
Dad was a jazz guy. Dad was big band, and then by just going through his record collection, listening to him, Buddy and Louie and Gene and all the greats, then I got into Joe Morello, the small group stuff.
So you were kind of first into jazz, and then what got you into more modern, you know,
rock
80s
and 80s
and 90s stuff?
Well, that's the benefit of having two older sisters.
I had two
older sisters that had the record player down in the basement that would be playing Zeppelin and Queen and Van Halen and all that stuff. And, you know, when you hear Zeppelin or hear Van Halen's first album, then... boom. You're mainlined in. Yeah, you're mainlined in. So then I got into rock from that.
Now, yeah. Did you have long hair?
I did, if you can believe it.
For sure.
I had beautiful long hair. Yeah. Did you? Okay.
Oh, yeah. I even had dreadlocks at one point.
No
Twice,
kidding.
Actually.
Yeah, all
like right around high school and then in the middle of college.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've had many, many a style and
sure.
over the years. Cool, man.
Yeah.
So you were doing the band thing. Did you guys, like, make good money? Did you have a good racket set up, or was it just more for the passion of the music?
No, I got into it. Certainly, I think my first playing professionally for money, if you will, was probably teens. But to offset costs of not making a lot of money, was to play in multiple bands.
Sure.
And what that allowed me to do was not only to play music, different musical styles, learn from different musicians, but generate revenue in different ways. But it also meant for me to keep a calendar, which was great. being on time for rehearsals, showing up gigs, not double booking, those type of things. That was great. That was a great experience. And I got even into a country band.
Yeah.
And I was playing with people that were in their 40s and 50s at the time, and I was in my teens.
So at this point, you're living, are you back in Chicagoland, or is
this is still back in Massachusetts.
Okay.
Still back in Massachusetts. Still living at mom and dad's house. And mom was a nurse, worked 11 to 7. Dad worked during the day. And of course, where do the bands always rehearse? They always rehearse at the drummer's house, usually.
Sure.
So my mom would work 11 to 7, and then she'd come home and try to sleep while I was rehearsing during the day with...
Did you have like a basement?
We had a basement.
At least that makes the sound a little bit... Yeah. You could absorb a little bit into the crowd.
Exactly. You try to soundproof it as best you can. But sure. At that time, carpet. I was playing... Yeah. We would get you know, heavy carpeting, and we'd go and get, you know, heavy-duty blankets and just hang them and layer them and just try to deaden the sound. And that's what we did. But I had a Ludwig set with 24s, 224s, so...
Oh yeah, so what was your first what was your first kit that you got that you started playing? Because I mean, your dad, what was he? Was he maybe like a Rodgers or Slingerland guy?
Slingerland guy.
Ah, okay, cool.
Slingerland guy. So my first set I got to play and grow up on it was Slingerland set, which I actually still have.
Oh really?
In storage.
That was your father's kit.
My father's kit.
What was that one? What were like the sizes?
I think a 20. I don't know if it was a 20, a 12, and a 14, or a 20, a 12, and a 16.
Right, yeah, it could be either.
And
that's a nice portable setup.
Oh, it was a great setup. Matter of fact, the plan is, now I still have it in storage back in Massachusetts, the plan is to ship it here and have maybe possibly you guys restore it or do whatever with it.
Yeah, we'd love to. We can take it apart, you know, give it a nice, you know, scrub down.
Sure.
You could make it all shine again.
Yeah, I want to put, you know, maybe if it needs new lugs or whatever, new the heads and all that, because it's still got the calfskin heads on it.
Oh, cool.
So, yeah, it's still. So started on that set, and then eighth grade graduation was, if I did well in school, I can pick out whatever set. I'm going to graduate eighth grade, do well in school, and we go to the drum store, and that's 1987. And what's anybody playing in 1987? The biggest set you can possibly find. The more drums, the bigger the diameter of the drums, everything. So, of course, I had to get, you know, double bass, 24s, you know, four rack toms, 16 and 18, just a mammoth kit.
Did you go for a Ludwig?
It was a Ludwig.
Yeah, that's why I figured.
It was a Ludwig.
Seeing as you're...
Yeah.
I think... I'm actually not a huge expert on 80s stuff, but... Yeah, I just...
The drums were so huge.
Yeah.
You know, and the stands back then were, you know, huge in diameter.
What kind of finish did you go for? Was it like a Vistalite?
Chrome.
Oh, chrome. So chrome over wood.
Chrome over wood.
Those are cool kits, man. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I still have a set. It's going to go to my nephew, who's also a drummer. But yeah, so nice. I graduated that set. And then when you realize you're playing opening sets in a bar...
Sure.
And you don't want to spend an hour and a half to set up.
Yeah.
A 10-piece drum set. Then I bought a small Pearl, you know, black set.
So were you kind of the booking guy when you were in all these different bands, or were you just the drummer? Were you kind of finding people who were doing that, or maybe was it a little bit kind of balanced between everybody?
Great question. I learned from the people that I was working with. They were all older than me. Usually they were 10, 20, 30, 40 years older than I was.
Yeah.
That I watched them and listened to them how they conducted business. And so eventually, I like to say at a young age, I started getting into the business side of it, booking, going out, seeking, whether it's a promoter, just a bartender, whoever you're talking to, whether it's just a bar or a lodge or whatever the booking is, I wanted to start doing that myself too, because I figured, you know, the more I do that, you know, the more opportunity hopefully I'll have. So
yeah, that's a cool thing about this podcast. Anyone who's listening, who's maybe younger that is interested in trying to pursue some sort of musical career, yeah, you always have to have the business side. And I've interviewed a lot of different people, and I sometimes go into that, like, you know, how did you use your creativity to, you know, set stuff up and make things happen? Because there are plenty of people out there who are great players but just don't really do all that much because they have never looked into that side of the, you know.
Totally.
Because, yeah, if you can write a million tunes that are really, really just killer.
Yeah.
And then never anyone have anyone hear them, which is kind of sad, actually. You got to have at least one guy in the band who's like, you know, busting his butt, you know, going out there and meeting people and networking. And yeah, it's always been different. My dad, he talked about shops and then the unions.
Okay.
You know. Did you join the union at all when you were out in Massachusetts?
No, it wasn't as prominent, or at least right. in the circles that I was
this
in.
This is kind of when, a little later, when it definitely wasn't as prominent, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. It wasn't as prominent at the time when I was playing, but I would have done whatever I needed to do, you know, definitely sure. to work. But yeah, any type of success that I've ever had in business from a performance standpoint as a musician, it's always been essentially going out and get the business.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Do you remember the names of any of the bands that you were in?
Yeah, I was in a rock band called Big Pain.
Big Pain? Yeah, very nice.
I was in another band called Tree of Life, which was, we were doing the Prince stuff and Living Color. And a lot of that
cool,
stuff,
man.
Which is great.
Yeah, Prince tunes are so cool. They'll have some kind of weird, like, there's like one measure missing. You know
yeah.
what I mean? Or they'll add one measure.
Like, sure.
Like the forms are really creative. That's one thing I really
great
like.
Writer.
Prince's,
great
Prince's
writer.
Stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. then the country band, I was in a band called Second Wind, which was all, you know, all country. And I learned from everything from Hank Williams Sr. all the way to, at the time we were playing, Alan Jackson stuff. So nice. that was fantastic. I love playing country music.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And then so eventually, I guess this is kind of covering your high school years at this
high
point.
High school,
maybe
a little bit after, a little during college, a little after college.
So what made you decide to do college?
Hockey. I was also a hockey player.
Oh, really?
So growing up in Massachusetts.
Played hockey in college?
Played hockey.
Cool. I never knew that about
you. Yeah. Yeah. Hockey was huge. So I played hockey too, and then,
but was your major music?
No, just general studies. It was, you know, business, that type of thing. I never studied outside of music when I was studying with the drum instructor, Randy Kay. I never studied, you know, formally in school. I considered Berkeley. My parents took me to Berkeley. I sat in the lobby. We took the tour. I looked around. You sit in the lobby and it's the most intimidating place you've ever been in your life. You know,
yeah.
You look at every great artist you can ever imagine in the world of music, particularly jazz and fusion, you know, went to Berkeley at some capacity. So I wasn't sure. And so I just decided, you know, not to go. My parents aren't going to spend the money if I wasn't, you know, 100% sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. I mean, that's, yeah, I've heard mixed things about Berkeley. In that era, though, I've heard mostly good things. Yeah,
the greats coming out of there, yeah.
Right, and yeah, sometimes I've heard, like, there's too many guitars, they have issues with that, but too many drummers, maybe. But that happens, I think, at every school. The school I went to, there was, like, never any bass players. The first 2 years, freshman and sophomore, there was, like, one bass player, like, six drummers. They came each year, one bass player for 12. I'm not even exaggerating.
Looks like those guys were working a lot then.
Well, I mean, yeah, and then the older guys had to come and play a little bit, and
uh-huh.
it might have not quite been that bad, but
yeah.
And then, yeah, there were some guys who were a little more experienced than others. There was one bass player that everyone kind of wanted to play with, but yeah, I know that my year that I started there was just. Yeah, there was one guy. And then the next year it might have been two that came in, but just one guy. And I think there were at least five drummers. And then there were other classical guys. This uh-huh. is just on the jazz side of things, but
sure, sure.
But yeah, that's a difficulty at just about every college, I think, or every school. You know, you're a high school teacher trying to put together, hey, maybe you should try, you ever thought about trying tuba?
Yeah.
You know, the instruments that... Which is actually a really cool instrument, but
it's a fantastic instrument.
Yeah,
I love the tuba.
A little heavy to move around, but
yeah,
yeah.
But very much in demand.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can get tuba. I bet you can get tuba gigs easier than getting drum gigs.
Yeah.
I know a bass player who does tuba stuff as well as bass stuff. He knows
Do
both
you?
Of them. Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Believe it or not.
That's cool.
Yeah. But yeah, so. So when did you end up moving out to the Chicago area? Yeah.
95, December of 95, picked
okay.
up, packed everything in the car, drove. I came out with my father for a family reunion about a year or two before and spent some time in the area. I'd always have been coming back and forth because we have relatives out here.
Right.
So we came out, we did a family reunion, fell in love with the area, and I wanted to make a go of it, you know, from a career standpoint. And it was really, at that time, was considering three major places. It was going to be New York, it was going to be LA, it was going to be Chicago. Being the fact that I had family out here, I said, let's give it a go in Chicago. And
so this is like a little bit after college?
Yeah.
And where was the college you went to? Was it in
Amherst, okay. Massachusetts.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
And then, so that was the reason you just wanted to go to a big city and you kind of felt some connections in this city because of your family's
background? Yeah, I had cousins and aunts and uncles out here that I could, you know, you could rely upon or to spend time with and come into a larger area.
Yeah.
So I came out here in 95 and I was starting to go out and auditions probably within a week. You know, I brought my cymbals with.
Are you still playing that huge Ludwig kit at this
no.
point?
No. it's in storage. It's going to go to my nephew. Yeah, thankfully, I don't have to lug that around in gigs anymore.
Oh, no. I mean, at this point in 95 when you moved out.
Oh, no. I just brought my cymbals with.
I know you don't play it anymore. Yeah. I've seen you play a bunch of times.
Yeah, that's for sure.
That would be a little excessive at some of those gigs.
Yeah, for sure. came out here, brought the cymbals, bought a set out here, and then started going to auditions and started to gig pretty quickly, you know, probably within a couple weeks.
And were you, at this point, were you getting back into jazz a little bit, or were you still doing mostly, you know, rock and roll stuff?
At the time, from a gig standpoint, I was doing kind of the alternative scene was really big. Jim Blossoms, Smashing Pumpkins were big here locally.
And like grunge stuff.
Grunge stuff. So I was doing the Metro gigs and playing clubs downtown, but you were playing on bills with three or four or five bands on the night, and you're playing for the door. That means you're not making anything.
Sure.
And
did you have like a flannel?
No, I didn't do the flannel thing. Not yet, at a time yet. No.
And torn jeans and...
I had cut my hair, though.
Four-piece kit. Yeah. Because that's a funny thing about grunge. Yeah, that's when kind of the kits got much smaller.
Kits got smaller.
Which is better for us drummers, I think. It makes our job a little easier. Yeah,
it did. Especially if you're going on, you're playing 20, 30-minute sets. You know, so sure. It made sense. But I did cut my hair. So I had the time. I still had hair. It was a little bit past the ear, which was the appropriate...
Sure.
Length for, you know, for the grunge scene. So I was playing those clubs, but I wasn't making a lot of money. Came out.
Do you remember you said maybe the Metro you played at?
Played the Metro, played
some other places,
Wrigleyville.
Some places people might remember, you know.
Cubby Bear. What else was it?
Cubby Bear is a cool joint.
It is a cool place. I played a place called Sluggers.
Yeah,
which
yeah.
Which is in Wrigleyville.
Did you ever do. The dueling pianos thing at Sluggers?
No, I have not.
There was I never played there, but I used to go see people play at Sluggers.
Okay. Because
they had like two floors, right?
They do.
And upstairs, was that where you played? It was.
I think it was.
When I was going there, it was kind of set up as like a little bit of a nice kind of lounge, and they had two pianos. And I think they would do like a. This is a long time ago. I can barely remember. This is when I was in college. But.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't remember, you know, what the setup was, but it was. I think there was two rooms. It was great. Sublime, 311 started that type of music started to come into play. So we were doing just a lot of covers and those type of things. Try to throw in some of your originals.
Sublime's an awesome band. I really like their music.
Absolutely,
that stuff really holds up.
Oh yeah, yeah. I still listen to their. I have some of their albums. I still listen to. So, but after doing that, playing clubs and going through my savings pretty quickly.
Sure. Yeah. And where were you staying at this point, too? Did you find family or did you?
No, I had an apartment.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I got a studio apartment and was living there. And but I was spending all the time downtown because
sure.
I moved to Chicago. The guys in the band that I had joined were a few years older and experienced in New Chicago. So that, you know, Tuesday night, Wednesday night, Thursday night, even if we weren't playing or gigging, we were down at, you know, in Wrigleyville or we're down in Rush Street or whatever and spending money like a drunken sailor, you know
for
what
sure.
I mean? So I blew through that and I realized, you know, I have to get a job because I got to pay rent.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I got to pay bills and I got to grow up at some point. So,
sure.
Yeah. So what I did was I started working in as an activity director in nursing homes.
Okay, sure, yeah.
And started working in senior living. I had no experience at all, but other than my mom was a nurse, and I would go with her when I was younger to she would work in retirement communities. So I always was comfortable around seniors and loved, you know, being with them and experience. And
sure.
So I got into the senior industry, you know, and started working with that. Still gigging, still playing weekends and occasional weeknights, but I had to make money. You know,
yeah,
I really had to make serious money. So I started doing that. And I was, you and I were talking previously, I have a great story about the shop that was on right across where it used to be across from the art museum, right?
So this would be like your first time
at Maxwell's.
Let's hear it.
So my dad was still traveling, and he'd do some business in Chicago. By then he had gotten out of the music business. He was into flashcards and working with Motorola. And so he had some business in Chicago. So sometimes he would stop off in Chicago, do some business here, then keep heading out to Las Vegas for a convention or Los Angeles. And so I had found out about Maxwell Drum Shop. And I said, oh, this is incredible. And I don't even remember if I even found it online or I just saw it in you know, music publication or whatever. So I had called, Dad came in over the weekend, and I had called the shop, and I just left a general voicemail. I didn't even know what the hours were. And I can't remember the name of the guy who was working for me at the time.
But probably Ben.
Maybe. This is probably 96, 97.
Because at that point, it was either him or my dad you would have talked
okay,
to.
Okay, yeah. And he called up. He said, no, if you guys want to come in, I said, are you guys open on a Sunday? And he said, no, but I'll come in, I'll meet you, and I'll open the shop.
Oh, nice.
And I was just flabbergasted. I mean, how nice of a guy. So Dad was staying with me at the time. We drove in, and we got in, and, you know, we walked around. It was just jaws hit the ground. Jaws hit the ground immediately. It was just an amazing store.
And that was the one on the 8th floor in the Fine Arts Building?
Yeah.
Because there was a smaller one upstairs, but then right around then, yeah, it sounds like this would have been a couple years into when the shop had really gotten going in the Fine Arts Building, and we had that big long room with the window at the end.
Yes.
And these two things, the Duke Ellington and Barry yes. Deems things, one of which had the Buddy Rich kid on it. And
yes.
The Rufus Jones kid on the other one.
Yes, exactly.
There are pictures all over the internet of that.
Yeah, I got a picture of my dad next to the Buddy Rich set.
Cool.
In the shop.
You should, if you have that, send yes. it to me, and I'll put it up on the YouTube version of this.
I will.
People can scope it out.
Oh, he was in heaven because yeah. he was, you know, he was the biggest Buddy fan, and always used to see Buddy when he would come in Chicago.
That's awesome, man. I'm glad he got to see this.
Oh, show. he was thrilled. So it was amazing experience. It was so nice of your employee to come in and meet us, open the shop on a Sunday, and I remember my dad was talking about Frank's, you know, Frank's Drum Shop. And
sure.
he'd always tell me stories about Frank's. I never made it, but he'd always tell me about, you know, all the cats would come in, and everybody would go to Frank's. And so he was talking to, I think you were saying, is Ben, and he said, I remember these huge drumsticks that Frank's had, and it said Frank's on it. And he pulled out, and you guys had
yeah.
the drum set, you know, the drumsticks from the.
We still got them too. Yeah, you've seen them in the other room.
I did.
Right?
I did.
One of them has like a little bit of a burn mark from I think a light that it was next to it or something like that.
Yeah. Exactly. I thought my dad was going to cry. I mean, I thought he was literally tearing up, going, "I can't believe you guys have it. This is amazing." So yeah,
that's awesome.
It was the best experience, you know, and obviously have followed you guys since you've progressed all the way to this store.
Yeah. Very cool. Very yeah. cool. That's awesome. So then you do the retirement home stuff, which is really cool. You worked with my grandma.
Yes.
And you do like yeah, kind of like activities, and it's
yeah.
just fun stuff for people to kind of keep their you know, their yeah, keep their minds active and
yeah.
you know, and just yeah, you play like old tunes that they know really well. And I think you make a lot of people happy with what you do, which is awesome.
Well, that's the payoff. So to make a long story short, to going from in the senior industry, and I started my own consulting company, to working into senior communities and performing more and more, even though I was still gigging clubs and bars and all those type of things. And I realized, you know, this is great. I started working more and more with senior communities and park districts and libraries too and all that. And I realized, you know,
so, yeah, you do some stuff with kids as well.
Like, I do. I do some kid groups, group settings.
That's what you seem to be like really, really good at.
Yeah, and I went all in. I mean, all in performance. That's my, you know, that's my profession now, and I'm glad to be making a living at doing it. But yeah, so drum circle groups,
right,
which are phenomenal. And a lot of times I'll do in for the scenic communities. I'll go in and do a program on say Nat King Cole or the big bands era or Chicago dance clubs, you know, the Aragon, the Trianon, the Willowbrook Ballroom, and some of our lectures, but a lot of times as music performances. The awesome thing about it is no matter how much I'm lecturing and talking about it, performing about it, you have seniors coming up to you saying, I saw Harry James there back in 1937 and,
sure,
you know, Buddy was playing or whatever. I saw Duke Ellington's band or I met Louis Belson or whatever. That's the awesome stories about it. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. That's really fantastic. Yeah, you must have really heard some really sweet stories. Yeah, those old ballrooms, I wish I could have seen. I mean, there still are people that play in those. I've seen. You ever go out and watch like trad jazz, like traditional jazz stuff?
I've seen some stuff online about it. Yeah,
you can. Mike Albaniak, he's a good friend of mine. He's a local musician.
Yeah.
I haven't seen him in a little while, but if you go into our jam session videos on YouTube, there's a bunch that's a trad jazz group, which means traditional jazz.
Sure.
It's kind of like Dixieland, but it's the Chicago version of it, you know,
okay,
which is different than stuff that's from like, it's very different. It's actually, it's interesting stuff. There's a lot of hits. There's a lot of stuff you got to know.
Yeah.
And you only learn it by playing it. And it's interesting, kind of sad, I guess, because, yeah, not too many people know how to do it anymore.
Mm.
And some, a lot of young musicians, I think they listen to it and they just, they go, oh, I could do that. And it's like, well, no. Like, think about it. Actually watch what he's doing. They play really, really quietly. It's
okay,
almost as if there's like no amplification.
Sure.
They play in these big halls. And I'm talking like really quietly.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that I'm impressed with on your playing. You've got a nice tasty feel, which is like.
Thank you.
You know, and it's funny because I didn't know you had such a like a rock background. And yeah, let me ask you.
Sure.
How did you transfer from playing, hitting so hard to playing more kind of tasty light stuff?
Two easy things. One was my dad and being raised on jazz.
Right, right.
Second was wanting to work.
Sure, sure, yeah.
So
do what your boss tells you.
Exactly. I learned really quickly, like when I was starting to work, you know, the hotels in Chicago or playing like the John Hancock or going up and you're in a room and you're playing a dinner and there's people that are sitting 5 to 7 feet from you.
Right, right.
You better learn how to play the brushes pretty quick. So it was just, you know, trial and error and learning how to play very quietly.
There's nothing wrong. I was watching this video the other day about this guy who was playing at some gig. It was a YouTube video, and he was like, "What's the point of them bringing music here if it's just going to be in the background?" And it's like, well, I mean, it's their establishment. You know, if they want to bring you in to be in the background, then just, you know, be in the background.
You want to get paid?
Yeah.
Want to make a living? You got to work. You got to do what's required on the gig.
And yeah, sometimes you'll be able to really.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's all about you. And
sure.
Those are the ones that are the most fun.
Sure.
I'm kind of a.
Like
I'm
the
actually
jams.
A fairly loud player most of the time, but I can if I need to. I'm kind of a dynamic player. That's kind of how I would describe my playing. I'll get really loud, but then sometimes I'll be really quiet and kind of do the whole thing. But yeah, back to Mike and the trad jazz stuff. Man, he really stays out of the way, but then he gets those hits every time. And there are some really specific hits in this music.
Sure.
So if you just listen, you'd be like, oh, that's easy. Yeah, it's not so easy, actually. And it was cool. I went to go see them. It was some place in like the southwest suburbs. I can't remember exactly what it was called, but it was a really big ballroom. And, you know, they had banjo. And there were probably 200 people there.
Yeah.
And everyone was dancing. It was really cool. Oh, it was really fun. Yeah. I had a good time. If I ever go again, I'll invite
you to
come. I'm so busy nowadays. You can't usually. And then, right now there's not a lot of big shows happening at all. But it'll all come back, you know.
It will.
but that style of music is really fun stuff.
Sure.
Yeah. Do you ever do like Artie Shaw stuff? Like, do you go that far back?
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of Artie Shaw. I love
clarinet
stuff, man.
Oh, it's amazing, Benny.
Just fun
Artie
music.
Shaw. Yeah, it's amazing music. That was the time and era where you had the greatest musicians playing the most popular music in the world.
For sure.
Everybody was buying the albums. They were playing everywhere. They were on TV. They were in movies. Yeah.
Yeah,
it was the best era.
Like being able to play really well and proficiently was an essential part of day-to-day life, you know? I mean, yeah, even during like the war, even during like really, really hard times, it's like a morale thing. Huge. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and socially, the dancing, the Aragons and the Trianons and the Willowbrooks and all those great places, dancing played such an intricate part of socialization. It was as popular as going to the movies for couples back in the day. Yeah. So, I mean, you'd pack 3,500 into the Aragon every single night, you know, the bands are playing.
That's so cool. Yeah. There are some little things that go on that are, like I know that the, what's the club on Thursdays on the north side, not Green Dolphin Street, that used to be.
The Green Mill?
Green Mill, yeah.
Yeah.
They do some cool old-fashioned stuff where people dance and they like dress up and stuff like that. I've never gone, but it seems like it would be really fun.
Fitzgerald's, I think, still has a big band play there, too, as well.
Cool.
They have that.
I know they have big bands. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I actually know some of the guys that run the big bands. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's a lot of dancing going on, though.
Probably not, knowing the size of the
place.
That's
more about just the kind of sit down and dig the music.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's very cool. It's funny, how over the years... culture just in America, it just changes so quickly. You know, like you go from one phase to another. I mean, just now in our conversations, we've gone all the way from like the 20s and then, you know, the 40s and then the 60s.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, we didn't really talk too much about the 60s, but I've on another podcast, I've covered that extensively. You know, the 80s.
80s where music. Yeah.
I guess people were kind of dancing. But it's different. Yeah. It's a little bit different. And then, you know, why do people stop dancing to jazz? In the bebop era, they actually had signs that said no dancing allowed because they wanted people, which is, it's kind of interesting. I mean, I see what they're going for, but it's also a little kind of sad. I mean, and then people still like to go out dancing, but nowadays you go to the club and I'm not big on that myself. It's a DJ and it's so loud, you feel like you're gonna like explode the bass.
All you hear is the bass coming from a mile away. I know.
And it's just it keeps getting more and more intense. Sometimes I think like, what are they gonna do next? Maybe my kids, like what are clubs gonna be like when they're.
I wonder if they'll even have clubs anymore.
Who knows? I mean,
probably do stuff on their computer.
Yeah, we'll have like a holodeck. I don't know if you ever watched Star Trek, but like we'll have a holodeck where you just. Go in there, and it's an artificial environment.
Yeah. Maybe the Jetsons had it right all those years, right?
Sure, yeah. definitely. Yeah, everything keeps chugging along, though. You know, changes happen, and you got to be creative to figure out a way to...
You do.
To stay, you know,
to stay relevant. Yeah. Absolutely. Stay relevant, stay working, and constantly... You guys provide a great opportunity with the jams here, which are awesome.
Yeah, for sure. You played a bunch of those.
I played a bunch of them. Always have a good time. You get to meet other musicians.
How's... who's that bass player that you always used to play with?
Tim Hayes?
Tim, yeah, I remember. It's got the same name as you. Yeah,
Tim's great. Yeah, he's doing good.
Awesome. I miss him, yeah.
Yeah, I fill in every once in a while for his band, and when they need if their drummer can't make it, their first call guy. Anytime I have a chance to play with Tim, he's a great musician, great guy, very knowledgeable, tons of experience. So I just love.
He does some cool vocal stuff. Plays
great vocals,
bass,
yeah.
So that's great. Two things to cover. I mean,
stand up bass.
He'll always have work. I think.
Yeah, stand up bass players. It's great to play stand up. Yeah,
for sure.
So,
and then. Yeah, I mean, you've talked about some of your influences, but why not just touch on maybe, like, who are some... I guess they don't have to be jazz drummers. We focus a lot on jazz stuff. But, yeah, just maybe name, like, five or six drummers that have really influenced you over the years. Maybe people that are a little less known, if you can, just because, you know. But yeah, whoever's really, you know...
Well, going back, I mean, obviously I was raised on... obviously Buddy played the biggest role. My dad was the biggest fan. And those guys, Ed Shaughnessy and Gene and Louie. Then getting into the small group, Joe Morello, his ride alone was mind-blowing. I definitely went through the fusion years of Tony Williams and all those great drummers, too. The guy that I continued to go back to all the time for repertoire, playing all styles of music, and being so versatile is Steve Gadd. Just, you know.
Steve Gadd, cool. I think that's the first time we've talked about him on the podcast,
actually. Steve is my, you know, outside of Buddy, is my biggest influence. And
do you play in any rock groups now?
I play rock, gigs. I'll play rock gigs.
I'm not in any bands. Play any gig. I'd love to come check you out.
Sure. If the gig calls for it, I mean, I'll play whatever's needed.
Sure.
Al Foster. Love Al Foster. Amazing drummer. You know, guys who are versatile, guys who play different styles, guys that can sit in and play authentic jazz, authentic blues, authentic country music. Those are the guys that inspire me. And going back, and it's just kind of going back and listening to stuff like Hank Williams, going back and listening to Muddy Waters, B.B. King, those drummers, those guys that played in that style, in that era, those are the guys that I love. That's what I've been doing, spending a lot of time going back and listening to guys that have played that style of music and on the road. You know, for years, those are the guys that are, you know, blown my mind for sure. Steve Smith.
Yeah, he's, I like his swing feel a lot.
Yeah.
A lot of this, there are less and less people who can really do like a legit nice like swing feel. And he's got a cool one. I like his. I think he plays a lot of that old school 30s and 40s stuff really authentically.
Yeah.
The rudiments he chooses and the
rudiments.
He doesn't hit the toms a ton. You know, you use them as accents. That's one thing old school drummers did that was so different. And like a lot of the old school drummers would lead the phrase with snare drum, whereas nowadays almost all, like every video I see on YouTube, every single phrase starts with a double kick on the bass drum.
Feet. Yep.
Like every single one. It's okay to do that sometimes, but to me, it gets a little bit, I don't know. It's like, because it's the biggest drum you have.
Yeah.
And if you use it like all the time.
Yeah.
To me, it just becomes, it's almost like obnoxious sometimes. I don't know.
Well, it starts to sound the same, doesn't it? And then the music starts to be written around that as well.
Yeah.
And then you fall into that loophole. It's almost like the bottom has become the top, and the top you know, really... almost playing like what the bass drum used to be playing, you know. But I was
real eloquent about the usage of the bass drum minimally, and that comes from, you know, pre-amplification, I think.
Amazing to go in and hear Papa Joe Jones. I go back and I'll still watch video of him, and he's playing with brushes behind the big band, and he still sounds like a freight train coming in, you know. Right. I mean, that's the amazing thing about Papa.
I always say he's probably my favorite drummer just to watch. I mean, he's such a great performer.
Liquid.
Yeah.
Pure liquid in how he played and phrased. So a lot of those guys, Steve Smith, Steve Gadd, I know you're saying not, you know, necessarily big name guys, but my dad, 1988, 89, took me to go see the Chick Corea Trio, and that's when I was exposed to Dave Weckl.
Yeah.
And that was... you know, just blew my mind on that too. That was a whole another world getting into. And then I got to go see, he also took me to go see Dennis Chambers. Nice. I got to see Dennis play and got to meet Dennis. And, you know, that was a mind blower too as well. So, yeah.
Yeah, man, all really good names.
Yeah, if you're a great drummer, I mean, I dig you. You know, I love to listen to a lot of different guys, but I tend to go back to the different eras or different styles of music and listen to the guys play, you know, very authentic blues or country or you know, whatever the style is. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
And then what about, so what kit are you playing on now?
So I use, depending on the gig, I have a Sonar, I think it's the Martini set, which is, it's hysterical. I think it's a 14.
Yeah.
It's a 14 bass drum. I play that, so I play at the Gale Street Inn, the restaurant and the north side, usually on Monday nights. And I've had some drummers come up to me, and it's hysterical that some of the guys are familiar with the kit. Some of the guys will come in and just laugh and go, what is that? You know, what is so the size tiny. Of it? Yeah, exactly. So that, but it works. I love that kit. I play it obviously wide open, and it's perfect.
Yeah, they're good solid drums.
They are. I have a Mapex with an 18.
I think I might have seen you play that one once.
Yeah. Yep.
Maybe. I can't remember that. This was probably 2-3 years ago now when I saw it. Because my grandma was staying at the place, and you were doing just kind of jazz standards.
Yeah.
Which it was really nice. Yeah. I think the people just loved it. And she was never, she was never huge into jazz music, but I still think she had a good time. She was into kind of almost like R&B singer stuff.
Okay.
Kind of like, I can't even remember. It was kind of smooth, like, with, I can't remember.
What standard AM used to be? what AM radio would be on? You mean that type of stuff?
Maybe, yeah. I can't remember like the station she used to listen to, but she would always have the same one on. I remember. Yeah. And you know, it was, yeah, you know, it was all right.
My mom would do the same thing. My mom would have a radio on in the kitchen and she'd be, you know, cooking or doing whatever she's doing. And it was great because AM radio, you would have, you'd listen to either Anita Baker or Ann Murray, or you'd have Hall & Oates on it, or Sonny and Cher, or whatever, you know, growing up as a kid. So, so Mapex Sonar, and I have a D-Drum kit with an 18. That's a Mother Pearl. I use that that set, and I have way up in storage, I have a Tama set, too. That's a 22. I don't usually get that baby out too much because it's a big bass drum and I don't usually use it.
It's for the rock gigs.
Yeah, if I'm playing an outdoor festival or something a little louder, sure, or whatever. But the way the engineering is done now, as you know, and I can go in and do an outdoor. I played the Ice of the Sky Festival last summer with a D drum set in 18, and
it worked. Yeah. What about what's your favorite snare drum?
Gretsch.
Gretsch.
Yeah, I love. I have some Gretsch sets, Gretsch snares that I use. I rotate different ones.
Like a metal one or a wood one? Or just
it's a metal one.
Ah, cool, man.
Yeah, it's a metal one. I love that. That's my go-to. I use that usually most gigs.
Yeah, their snares are kind of punchy. Those die-cast hoops, yep. You know, gives you a nice... And they're really easy to dial down a little bit to not be too... I played a gig a little while ago that, man, it was like the livest room ever, and I used muffling on the drums, and I muffled the cymbal a little bit just because it was so live, you know.
Did it really? Everything was...
But it worked. It's almost like the wallet trick. Just put your wallet on your snare drum, you know, that kind of thing.
Get a Costanza wallet.
Yeah. Yeah, because, and it... You don't have to, but it just makes it so that when you're playing, it... Because to play, like, really quiet, really fast for a really long time is incredibly taxing. But if you put that on there, you can just relax a little bit when you're playing. You know what I mean? That's how it feels for me.
Sure, you can still lay in a little bit. And
right, that's why they used to have tone controls in all the drums, you know?
Yeah.
Playing in those big, boomy places and with less amplification, if sometimes none, you know?
Sure. I have a Mapex, too. That's a hand-hammered. It's a real sensitive snare, but the brushes cut through on it because I usually use brushes on this particular gig. They use it on, but it's great. And if you go to sticks, you can kind of lay into it a little bit, and it's still not going to be too pronounced and too bright and too loud. And
right,
you know, some of the club owners, some of the restaurant owners, as soon as they see sticks come out,
yeah,
they're, you know, so you start literally see them sweating and, you know, starting to shake. So
for sure.
Oh no, a stick.
I know what you mean, man. Yeah. Oh geez, everyone's gonna leave. Yeah, yeah. I've played at bars before where it was just some band and it was kind of like a rock band where like you start playing and like five people leave like right away. You know, it's like, oh geez, maybe we should turn it down a little bit. You know,
yeah.
Depending, you know, there's just so many different genres of music out there, and you might, let's say you start with like a really aggressive blues tune and you're uh-huh. playing loud, and some people might just not be into that, you know? So just, all right, let's go to the next place.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I've played the goofiest gigs you could imagine. I remember I was playing a gig in, it was near like Boys Town, and there was, you know, on, what was it? On Halstead.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a little south of it, but there was just like no one there. And then all of a sudden, all these guys come from Boys Town and they start dancing. And they were just, it was so awesome that they came by. They just were walking by.
Yeah.
And they started dancing and they were just like the most, you know, lively bunch. One of the guys threatened to kill me if I stopped playing because he was having so much fun dancing. So if you stop playing that beat, we were doing kind of like disco stuff, a lot of disco groups, which can be fun. Yeah, were you ever in like a disco group? That's one thing we never really, that was kind of in there in the
I mean, 80s. I played whatever was needed for the gig. I mean, I've done my billions of weddings and playing that, you know, the pulsating hi-hat, just keeping that groove going. And then
disco, a lot of it's really bad, but some of that stuff's actually really cool.
Like, oh, yeah.
You get that like real nice funky bass line going mm-hmm. on. And, you
know, oh, it's the nice bass drives it. Move. Yeah. Hi-hat and bass drum. Yeah. I mean, the bass and the hi-hat
right.
driving it. But yeah, if it's good, I dig it. And a lot of Donna Summer for sure.
Yeah, man. Well, yeah. Anything else you wanted to touch on?
Thank you for the opportunity.
Sure.
The shop is amazing. It's every time I come in, you know, besides the new sets that you have, but the vintage sets, is amazing. And when you, when I have a chance, we're just talking about like Dejanet's set right out there.
Yeah.
I'm sitting there. I come in. I look at it. I go, that looks like a set that Jack would have played. And you go, yeah, matter of fact, that was one of Jack's sets.
I think it was on like so many different albums and live gigs.
Oh, yeah. And so that's the amazing thing. I mean,
for everyone, that's the one. It was in New York for a while. It's black, and then it has it's like a copper hardware.
Yeah, it looks like a copper. And then I as soon as I saw it, I thought of Jack because the black heads.
Yeah.
You know, that he I don't know if he still plays them, but I know I remember seeing him playing with them, and so I saw that. But and then there's a, is it a Rogers set back there? The Butch Miles.
Yeah.
double bass. I saw that back there too. So anytime I have a chance to come in the shop, it's awesome. And
you always got something cool and exciting.
You do.
It's new.
You do.
And you always, for those who go to the Chicago Drum Show, it looks like the one this year is going to be canceled, but then there's going to be a big one at the old venue next year. And Tim always helps us out. So if you want to meet Tim, if you come to the Chicago Drum Show, he'll probably be at our booth hanging out.
Yeah.
For many of you who are listening, you've probably been to the show and you've probably seen him there before. So
yeah, I love remember that show.
Yeah,
yeah.
And then is there any social media, maybe like site?
My website, like
Facebook.
Yeah. My website, which is timwilsey.com, Tim WILSEY.com, I post stuff on. I have some things on YouTube.
There's some of the jam session videos with you playing that I've put up before.
Yeah, so. I think so. Yeah, and then other gigs that I've done. So yeah, usually the website, and then I advertise a lot of times my gigs on WDCB, nice. 90.9, which is
That's
the best radio station in the world. That's my favorite radio station
for Chicagoland. That's the go-to place for
totally
for jazz.
Absolutely, it's my favorite. Yeah. So that, and then. Phone number, if I plug it, is 630-649-2647. And people will text me, hit me up, and are you available for a gig or where are you playing, those type of things. So, yeah.
Yeah, right on, man.
Yeah.
Cool. All right, well, yeah, pleasure talking
with
you.
Thanks for having me.
And then, check out our website, maxwelldrums.com. And the beginning, I say all the other things. And, yeah, everybody, thanks for listening. Y'all take care out there.
Cheers.